with Dave Spector asking the musical question. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored. That's you. Volunteer-operated, that's me. I'm down in the booth. We're operating, other people are operating remotely a lot. Maybe tomorrow will be my inaugural show of listening to my show from my backyard that I'll put together. Though I don't know, things change to the last minute. Let's see whether how Pacifica responds to the latest Inspector General sacking, if you haven't heard about that yet. I think it'll be spun in the Fox echo chamber as, well, the guy was questioning Pompeo's use of the, I guess it's the equivalent of the Secret Service protection groups for picking up his dog after a dog grooming, things like that. But actually, he was cooperating with some whistleblowers. And we've got some features on whistleblowers. The guy Bright, it's a bright idea. Pacifica covered the hearings this week about scientific integrity. It was a House committee meeting, of course. See the Senate talking about scientific integrity. Don't hold your breath. And it could be just kind of push something else out of the headlines. That seems to be a tactic. But there's a group called Groundswell, the wife of the now voluble Clarence Thomas is with a group called Groundswell. Bolton seems to have something to do with it. And they've been advocating for more aggregation of presidential power, the unitary executive argument and all that. We don't need no blankety-blank inspector generals just because the Congress passed a law saying that there should be one. They've been falling rapidly. We'll see what the humorist and my candidate for president, Harry Scheer, if Ukraine can have a comedian president, the USA could have one too. He's very acute, and he has a feature on his show called Tales of the Inspector General, and far be it, well, yeah, he's been doing it for quite some years. All right, on with the show, this one that is, and don't want to talk too much because I want to put on Mitch Jezerich, Cat Brooks. We don't hear Brian Edwards Tiekert. They did a co-anchored coverage of the hearings. And they have a little couple outtakes from Richard Bright's testimony. You can find the testimony. I'm going to highlight the last question that Cat Brooks asked one of their commentators, which was, what about this accusation of cronyism that was involved in three major complaints that Dr. Bright had for being sacked. It's a pretty complicated and dry story of drug companies and friends of friends and getting that contract renewed and things like that. But it smacks of the whole cronyism that seems to be going on with the upselling of PPP. Masks, raising the price, U.S. government brokering deals, and then selling on to someone else who can upsell it and take the profit. It's a revolting situation. All right, my usual features are Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentary. I'm going to kick it off with that. Amy Goodman's commentary. I haven't heard either of these, but they're regular features, and they're always radio-worthy. After that, Election Theft Report, they're doing it weekly. Greg Palast to be featured. And then we'll get to whatever we can of the segments from the coverage of the hearing on scientific integrity. What a concept. All right. Young Swede Holland had an assist and a goal in the first half. 3-1 Dortmund. Not a surprise. Okay, that's my sports report. The weather's beautiful. Enjoy yourself safely. Don't line up on front of cams to get your, what is it called? Blue, an energy drink and a bottle of vodka. Blue guy. They're going to be blue guys because they're going to be asphyxiating from COVID. COVID was my quip. And it's only funny if you have a twisted sense of humor. So have at it. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal commemorating the day of May 13th, a couple of days ago.
In memory of May 13th. In a matter of hours, the calendar will ring in May 13th, and it will mark the 35th year since the massacre on Mother's Day, 1985, when police, armed with military weapons, bombed a house in southwest Philadelphia, known by neighbors as the Move House. In the smoldering embers of the aftermath, 11 men, women, and children would be dead, martyrs of the Move organization. The only person to be criminally prosecuted for this catastrophe would be Ramona Africa, who barely escaped dying in the house, her arms permanently scarred by the red tongues of fire that bit her as she left the building, only to enter prison for the next 7 years. The bombers, the cops, they got pay raises, promotions, and pensions for bombing a home and the burning of over 60 houses. In a matter of hours, the city's first black mayor, Wilson Good, now a preacher, will apologize and asks his city to do the same. The city's once DA, Eddie Rendell, now protests the long draconian sentences that Move members were given, despite the fact that as governor, he was fully empowered to reduce their sentences during his 8-year stint and did nothing. The carnage of May 13th, 1985, wasn't just another Philadelphia story. It flashed across the nation and leaked, literally, around the world to tell the story of carnage everywhere in the world. Right-wing repressive forces and figures, like former LAPD chief Daryl Gates, hailed the action, calling Good his hero, and it ushered in an era of repression that was enshrined into the phenomenon of mass incarceration, with today millions under lock and key. That era, that energy, needs to be repudiated once and for all. From a prison nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Yeah. How many houses burned down? About 50? The whole neighborhood? Mumia, who used to be a stringer for WHYY, where Fresh Air has yet to do a program on them. On him. Here's Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier.
On South Dakota's Sioux reservations, checkpoints save lives. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. A standoff over safety and sovereignty is intensifying in South Dakota. Two indigenous tribes there, the Cheyenne River Sioux and the Oglala Sioux, established checkpoints on roads leading into their territories, ensuring all those seeking entry onto tribal lands are traveling for an approved essential reason and don't exhibit symptoms of COVID-19. On Friday, Republican South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, one of only 8 governors nationally who refused to issue a stay-at-home order, demanded they remove the checkpoints or face state government intervention. The checkpoints remain in place.
The main purpose of these checkpoints is to keep our people safe.
The checkpoints remain in place. Harold Frazier is the chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux. He spoke on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
You know, with our population, with our lack of medical facilities, things like that. We know, and we just look to our relatives to the south, the Navajo Nation, and see what's going on there, and that could easily be us.
Frazier was commenting on the massive COVID-19 outbreak on the Navajo Reservation. The Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation has 8 beds in its clinic and no intensive care unit. The nearest hospital in Rapid City is 3 hours away. Oglala Sioux Tribe President Julian Bearrunner explained his decision to create checkpoints in a Facebook Live video.
Governor Noem miscalculates our level of dedication to protect our most vulnerable people from crony capitalism thrust to force us to open our economy as they chose to do so. There is no way to place a value on what we have to lose if we let them insult us this way. My relatives, we have been here for millions of years. Whatever they brought to our lands has proven to be poison.
South Dakota Governor Noem is a staunch ally of President Trump and a frequent guest on the right-wing Fox News channel, applauding the largely white, heavily armed groups protesting stay-at-home orders in several state capitals in April. Noem told Fox News host Laura Ingraham,
"So many people give up their liberties for just a little bit of security, and they don't have to do that."
Even though South Dakota currently has one of the fastest-growing infection rates in the United States, Noem is promoting a return to normal, risking a surge of COVID-19 deaths. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is home to a massive Smithfield Foods slaughterhouse where 3,700 workers process close to 20,000 hogs daily. That plant became the most intense COVID-19 hotspot in the country. Of South Dakota's 3,723 confirmed positive cases and 39 deaths, over 3,000 of them and 34 of the deaths are from Minnehaha County, home to Sioux Falls and the Smithfield meatpacking plant. Governor Noem rejected pleas from local elected officials, workers, and union leaders to close the plant, relenting only when the outbreak became too huge to ignore. Then, on April 28th, President Trump signed an executive order invoking the Wartime Defense Production Act, preventing state and local governments from closing meatpacking plants. The Smithfield plant reopened on May 7th. The number of coronavirus infections is still climbing. Governor Noem said in a statement, "Our back-to-normal plan doesn't include new government programs, more red tape, prescriptive phases, tight controls, or anything of the like." She added, "Our plan continues to put the power of decision-making into the hands of the people where it belongs," unquote. Noem's stalwart defense of liberty, however, stops at the reservation boundaries. She supports armed white vigilantes who threaten Democratic governors in states like Wisconsin. But if Native Americans dare to protect public health on their sovereign territory, Governor Kristi Noem suddenly becomes a big fan of big government. The checkpoints work, by the way. One person stopped responded that they'd been in a known COVID-19 hotspot, which tribal authorities duly noted. Not long after, she reported feeling ill and within 8 hours had a positive COVID-19 test result. Tribal health officials perform rapid contact tracing and quarantine those who had been near the infected individual. The data collection at the checkpoint expedited the response and hopefully prevented further spread of the virus. The Oglala Sioux have just reported their first case this week and immediately imposed a reservation-wide one-day curfew. These two tribes, part of the Osheti Shakwan people, are no strangers to the depredations of white settlers. Sitting Bull observed in 1877, quote, "The love of possessions is a disease in them." He added, "They claim this mother of ours, the earth, for their own use and fence their neighbors away from her and deface her with their buildings and their refuse. All this is sacrilege," he said. The Cheyenne River and Oglala Sioux are doing all they can to stop the coronavirus from impacting the reservations. Their efforts at self-protection and mutual aid themselves are spreading, however. The Omaha Nation, not far to the south in Nebraska, has just established checkpoints of its own. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And there's a new call for Leonard Peltier to be released. He should be released on a number of reasons, but he has at least two underlying conditions that make him very susceptible to the COVID that is likely to or is already sweeping through prisons. I was doing a lot on that last week. Prisons were seen as a development project for a lot of rural communities, but it's really going to be a vector of the transmission and spread. And one that is alleged by an author at The Intercept that is not accounted for in the models that they're being used to. Anyway, so worse than projected. Here's the next one. This is Greg Palast's, I keep calling it election protection bulletin, but election theft report. Dennis Bernstein, a regular weekly feature I played it all through the last election cycle and intend to get it on as well as I can through this one.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear. Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax. Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot.
Well, welcome to another edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin during the pandemic. Joining us is our star, Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and many other books, one coming out just in a little bit. It's his new book, How Trump Stole 2020. That's right, How Trump Stole 2020. And of course, it's all about how we can stop him from stealing it. And of course, that's why we've created this Election Crimes Bulletin. Greg Palast, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Dennis.
Glad to have you with us. Well, lots of things are going on.
There's
a battle for the vote. What's on your front burner at the moment?
Well, actually, I'm looking at Wisconsin. We'll get more of that. I can't scoop myself, but I'll give you some of the inside. And I was just speaking to two Wisconsin elections commissioners. Here's the problem. There are many. I mean, you just heard from Mr. Craig. I mean, it's like you have, they're trying to push vote by mail and make it so people don't die when they vote, right? That seems like a kind of basic government function, which we seem to have trouble with. But I should note that if you don't, you know, he said we're trying to get every voter a card, trying to get every county to send out a card to every voter saying, do you want an absentee ballot, and try to get everyone an absentee ballot if they can, mail-in ballot. The problem is, if you are purged from the voter rolls, you're not going to get that card, and you're not going to get that ballot. If you get the card, then you get purged. You're still not going to get the ballot, even though you're waiting for it. By the time you find out that it hasn't arrived in time, you're out of luck. You haven't registered. You're not registered. And so one of the big issues of that disastrous, literally deadly election that's going to kill people when all the numbers are in, we're going to know that people died to vote in Wisconsin. That was for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The issue that people are concerned about with the court is that they have to determine whether 232,000 people are to be purged from the voter rolls. And the elections commissioners, by the way, half of them are Republicans, and even the Republicans don't want to purge these voters saying the list is phony. I'm going through the list now with my experts. And I can tell you this right now without giving you numbers. There are an awful lot of people, and usually young people and voters of color, but especially young voters, who have been targeted by this purge, and it's an overwhelmingly Democratic list. They know it. So if you're, I don't care whether you're in Wisconsin, but Wisconsin didn't invent purging legitimate voters. So I'm asking everyone what I say, like, a broken record, and I apologize if you're tired of me saying it. Please check your registrations. Please go online, whatever state you're in, Wisconsin, California, and anyone you know, tell them to check their registration. But we are looking at purges all over America, plus some of the other issues that come up with mail-in voting. And we have to, if we're going to move to mail-in voting, we have to get people prepared to do it right so you don't, you know, so when you go postal, it doesn't drop out the end of the mailbox. 22% of all mail-in ballots never get counted. I want to repeat that, Dennis. 22%, over 1 in 5 ballots just don't get counted. And the biggest problem, by the way, is things like the purge, where you don't get the ballot in the first place. I was just, by the way, looking at military ballots, if you're interested in that.
Of course, and I want to know, Greg, also how you know that 1 in 5 aren't counted. Are we sure of that?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're real sure of that. It could get worse with this election. That comes from the MIT Caltech study. It did quite an exhaustive study of the entire mail-in process. And if you're wondering why that happens, two things. Number one, we don't count all the votes in America. You know, I know that in the third grade when you ran for class president, they counted all the hands that were raised. But imagine if you were in Mrs. Gordon's class and she said, well, Johnny won, but we have to disqualify Louis' vote because, well, he's Hispanic. It's like, so that's kind of what happens in America. And so, number one, we don't count all the votes. For example, I just mentioned the military. while one of our news outlets talked about, oh, we've had no problems with mail-in voting. Military's done it since the Civil War. Well, guess what? Over 1 in 10 military ballots, which are mailed in by soldiers from overseas, more than 1 in 10 are rejected because they're not counted by the military. They're counted by your local, your state and your local county elections officials who are often quite hostile to those voters. In New Mexico, there was one precinct that said where all of the overseas military ballots are collected, and they didn't show a single vote for President of the United States in 2004. Now, do you think that no one in the military cares who their commander-in-chief is? We have tremendous problems with getting ballots counted. And then the second thing, the bigger one, according to the MIT Caltech study, is you don't get your ballot in the first place, right? You're in Wisconsin. You didn't know you were on the purge list. You got a postcard. You said, okay, send me a mail-in ballot, and it never arrived because between the postcard and the receiving the ballot, you got knocked off the voter rolls. They said, you moved. They said, you voted, your name is Jose Garcia, and they found another Jose Garcia in Texas, believe it or not, so you can't vote. So people don't get their ballots, or they don't get them in time, or they don't get counted, and it's very easy to mess up a mail-in ballot. So I'm working on those issues and how we warn people to avoid the problems for themselves and others, and also how you change the politics and policies but through court action or legislative action. But, you know, there's not a lot of time to correct a disastrous system. We just got to deal with the disaster.
All right. That's the voice of Greg Palast. This is the Election Crimes Bulletin. We have been doing this for years. This is all about our ability to team up with Greg Palast, who has been fighting this battle for many years. He oftentimes has to leave the country to get the word out, to sort of try and force it back into the United States. But this is now more crucial than ever, Greg. And we're talking in the context of a deadly and expansive pandemic, and it ain't going away. One has the feeling that the president thinks his best shot at getting reelected is to getting rid of killing as many people, I guess Democrat and Republican, as possible, but really creating chaos and undermining the vote. So the combination of all the things that the Republicans have been up to and Trump on the stump, I mean, we're in trouble.
Well, I mean, you could call it a Trump-demic because, you know, it's the virus didn't tell us not to take any action. Okay, that was not the virus. That's a political disaster. That's why I call it the Trump-demic. Because, you know, you can have a virus out there. It doesn't mean that it has to infect half a million Americans and travel the rest of the world. So I'm very, very concerned about these things. And we have other problems. And let me just stick with Wisconsin a minute. You know, again, because I was speaking with the elections commissioners who are panicked, both Democrats and Republicans. But obviously the Democrats are very concerned about the basic unfairness. For example, in Wisconsin, you have to have an official state photo ID to vote. Okay, it's a terrible idea, and we've talked about, you know, why any photo ID requirement is absurd. We didn't have them. It wasn't even legal in the United States until 2008, and yet before 2008, they can't point to cases of voter impersonation. So why do we even have that? But what's worse in Wisconsin is that you have to have the state photo ID, but if you have a state photo student ID from the University of Wisconsin, that cannot be used to vote. That's like, and you're talking, okay, 182,000 students in the University of Wisconsin system. Trump won by less than 23,000 votes. So, okay, they're talking about purging 10 times as many voters as Trump's margin, mostly Democrats. They are stopping students from voting using their student ID. Oh, don't worry, Dennis. You can exchange your regular student ID, which doesn't allow you to vote, for one that's properly formatted to allow you to vote by going into the Dean of Students office in Madison, like that system, which, of course, is closed. Right, but elections commissioner Ann Jacobs told me, says, well, why doesn't the university just make up? It can do two things. One, the state should change the rules so that, you know, a university ID is a university, you know, state ID is a state ID. But the other is, why doesn't the university change the ID at the University of Wisconsin? The answer is because Scott Walker, before the little scamp left, appointed a chancellor for the university who is not going to turn 182,000 students into 182,000 voting Democrats. So literally, you have a political appointee whose main job is not to make the university a better educational institution, but make sure his students sure as heck don't vote. That's what's going on. And that's just Wisconsin, which is a nice state. And then there's the states that are really hostile to voters, you know, which is the most of them. So, I mean, in Wisconsin, it's an open fight because the state is, as they say, purple. It goes back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. Actually, it shouldn't be purple because it's a solid union state. It's a progressive history state, and it's literally only through massive vote suppression that they were able to maintain even a few Republicans in there. It's not that I'm for or against Republicans or Democrats. It's just, you know, I think that the voters should choose which party they want to rule, and that wasn't happening in Wisconsin. But people, and the good, by the way, I want to add one footnote that's really important to our discussion. Despite the games in Wisconsin blocking the students from voting, ridiculous purges, all kinds of crazy stuff, do keep in mind that the progressive did win that last insane election for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You have a Democratic
governor.
Yeah, they died. Governor.
They had to die to do it. They had to die. I mean, it does remind one of the 60s and the battle of the black community and how they did have to die again for the vote. It's sort of a vague echo.
Well, it's not that vague because you really do have people. Yeah. I remember like Jesse Jackson and Reverend Lewis, Greg Lewis in Milwaukee and others, who said, look, you know, we had to die for the vote and we're going to die to keep it. You know, it's very, you know, in the African-American community, this still feels like pretty fresh history. So we're there again, but, you know, but in many states, we're going to have this continuing fight, and vote by mail is, it's not as simple as, we're for voting by mail, against voting by mail. We got to make sure it works and that people get their ballots, get them filled out properly. And, you know, in California, we have an effective all-mail balloting system. It's mail opt-out. In other words, you get your ballot in the mail unless you specifically opt out. And so we know that there are tremendous problems in California, including an unbelievable number of provisional ballots when people find out that they can't vote, they don't get their mail-in ballot, and they have to show up at the polling station. California, in 2016... had 1 million people were shunted to provisional ballots. 1 million, and 400,000 of those ballots were not counted. Now, does that mean that there are 400,000 criminal, fraudulent voters? I don't think so, Dennis. In fact, there weren't four because they didn't arrest any.
All right, listen, we're going to leave it there for this moment, Greg. You stay where you are. I want to let people know you have been listening to the Election Crimes Bulletin. We do it weekly with Greg Palast. He's got an important new book coming out, How Trump Stole 2020. Very relevant work. We're going to be talking more about that over the weeks and months as we get closer to the election and as the book comes out. But we will continue to do the Election Crimes Bulletin as we have done for years to try and work in a consistent way to protect the people's vote. Greg Palast, thanks for being with us. More to come. And we're going to take a break.
And that's Dennis Bernstein from his hunkering down home in San Francisco, dialing in remote to KPFA Berkeley with the show Flashpoints, flashpoints.net. I believe that was on Thursday. We're going to another Thursday episode from KPFA right away, Letters in Politics. It was a special coverage of Dr. Bright's testimony, the whistleblower. They have an interesting group of folks for the discussion. Catherine Ebon, I've been reading about. She has two interesting articles up on Vanity Fair about the Richard Bright and the malaria drug fiasco. Other guests you'll be hearing introduced, Zane Rizvi with Public Citizen and Tom Devine with the Government Accountability Project, who works with whistleblowers. We're going to go to that straight away because I think we ought to. And it's 10:28, halfway through. We'll be getting behind the news. I haven't downloaded that yet, reminding myself to do that and let you know what indeed Doug Henwood's program is about. I'm going to cut to the chase, the last part of the interview with Catherine Ebon, just to make sure I get it on. This is with Kat Brooks, who is a co-host with a show called Upfront out of KPFA. And Catherine Ebon, Bottle of Lies is her most recent book. I guess we'll hear that in the intro here. Or no, there won't be an intro because this is the last question. This is about the cronyism aspect of the whistleblower complaint.
Final question for you, Catherine Ebon. Talk a little bit about the third complaint that didn't get as much play this morning, that there was cronyism playing out in terms of rewarding these contracts and going to Jared Kushner's friends.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, and I was surprised that that really didn't come up very much. He made a whole set of allegations that basically the, millions of dollars that's been appropriated to the agency he ran, BARDA, and the millions of dollars available to stockpile drugs in what's called the Strategic National Stockpile, those contracts were being handed out to friends of his supervisor, Bob Cadillac. Now Cadillac and HHS itself, Health and Human Services, has pushed back very hard on those claims. But there's been, even now, a significant amount of reporting which appears to confirm some of those claims. So I think it's early days in this. The Office of Special Counsel, where Bright filed his whistleblower complaint, has said that it appears that he was pushed out in retaliation, but there's going to be an investigation. And I think we're still in a wait and see mode on what's going to happen.
And Cadillac is spelled K-A-D-L-E-C. The other allegation about cronyism predates the COVID thing and has to do with an anti-flu, antiviral alias, A-E-O-L-U-S, nice classical reference. And a guy who's a friend of Kushner, McManus, wanted his contract extended from this BARDA outfit. As I said, it's kind of dry, but it stinks. And I haven't heard enough coverage of that, as was just mentioned, which is why I led with it. Let's go on to some of Pacifica's special coverage following the Scientific Integrity House Committee Subcommittee meeting with Dr. Richard Bright. Not to be confused with Dr. Richard E. Bright, who's an interesting guy, a virologist who I ran into a bit ago. Okay, I was supposed to be getting Doug Henwood's Behind the News. We'll do that behind this news.
Podcast of Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. Today we are part of, and now we are, the post-show of live coverage of a House subcommittee this morning, which heard from Dr. Rick Bright, who headed the agency overseeing the development of vaccines. He testified as a whistleblower. He claims that he was removed from his position last month because he opposed the Trump administration's push to provide drugs that have not been fully tested. He also claims that his early calls for the production of PPEs were largely ignored. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I've been here all morning with my good friends and colleagues, Kat Brooks and Brian Edwards Tiekert, who host Pacifica Station KPFA's morning program called Upfront. We're going to break for news, but when we come back, we'll be joined by a whole panel of guests to talk about today's hearings. We'll also have highlights. That's all coming up after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandari.
The Eve Lives. Republican foreign officials. The Senate is expected to vote on whether to extend.
Only attempt, but actually doing, increasing the availability of the anti-malaria drugs, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, to drugs that have since been shown in studies, albeit small studies, that people who have taken those drugs that were almost twice as likely to die from COVID-19 than if they hadn't taken those drugs. It was a study that was done with veterans. In today's hearing, several Republicans pressed Dr. Rick Bright on the question of this anti-malaria drug, whose use President Trump again has touted. Bright explained to Virginia Republican Morgan Griffin why he resisted making the drug more widely available to people who are not under the direct supervision of a doctor.
This virus takes over a lot of your body and actually infects multiple organs in your body and causes significant inflammation and multi-organ shutdown in some cases before death. And acute respiratory distress syndrome, it really turns your lungs into a brick.
It's scary stuff. And you said, though, on hydroxychloroquine that, one of the problems was you might have a heart, irregular heartbeat. If you're worried about not having a heartbeat at all, that's really not, you're not worried about irregular if you don't have one at all. Am I not correct about that? I mean, that's the concern. People were dying out there, and here was the first one that showed some promise. Why wouldn't we want to accept an offer from a manufacturer to give us a lot of this and have it out there?
We need to do it carefully, sir. We have to make sure that when we have that information available, those potential drugs available, we are thinking outside the box.
Can't we be so careful that we actually accidentally kill people?
And that was Dr. Rick Bright responding to questions by Republican Representative Morgan Griffith of Virginia.
Dr. Bright also brought a warning this morning, and also it laid out another complaint that he had that he said that was largely ignored by the Trump administration. He says that in early January, he tried to warn the administration that it would need more emergency prepared equipment, including PPEs, for the eventual outbreak of the coronavirus here in the United States. He says his calls were largely ignored. Under questioning from House Subcommittee Chair Anna Eshoo of California, Bright laid out these early attempts.
And was there a failure to respond with the needed urgency when you correctly pushed to ramp up production of masks, respirators, syringes, swabs?
Congresswoman, we've known for quite some time that our stockpile is insufficient in having those critical personal protective equipment. So once this virus began spreading and became known to be a threat, I did feel quite concerned that we didn't have those supplies. I began pushing urgently in January, along with some industry colleagues as well. And those urges, those alarms were not responded to with action.
And instead of acting on your recommendations, was the response of others to try and cut you out of key meetings, marginalize your participation?
I was told that my urgings were causing a commotion, and I was removed from those meetings.
Again, that's Dr. Rick Bright, who's former and just recently removed about a month ago, but was the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority within the Department of Health and Human Services that oversees the development of vaccines for the country. This was live coverage. Again, this is a special broadcast that Letters and Politics is involved in. The station that this show originates out of, KPFA in Berkeley, has been dedicating this morning's hours to the coverage of the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Subcommittee on Health, which is chaired by Democratic Representative Anna Eshoo of California. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I have been broadcasting all morning with my two colleagues from KPFA's morning program called Upfront, Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Kat Brooks. Kat Brooks now joins me. Good morning, Kat.
Good morning, Mitch. Happy to be here with you. To our guest, Mitch, I want to get your general reaction to the hearing today. It was much more contentious than the hearing that we had on Tuesday in the Senate. It seemed like there was a lot of grandstanding on both the parts of Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, certainly more contentious than what we saw in the Senate, but I still maybe a little subdued of what I was kind of anticipating. I was thinking that coming into this hearing, it might start to resemble, in some ways it did, and we'll ask the people who've been covering this issue much closer than I have been, but I was expecting this hearing to resemble more of kind of the hearings that we had with the impeachment process of President Donald Trump earlier in the year. And what I mean by that, and it's not that that didn't happen today, I just don't think it was as vociferous as we've seen with many of the former administration officials who came out and spoke against Donald Trump during the impeachment process. But I was expecting, and we did hear, I shouldn't say we didn't hear, an effort to try to undermine and make Rick Bright look more like a disgruntled employee, which the spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services has done, which Donald Trump has done himself. It certainly was there. I guess I was anticipating it to be more intense than it was, but I think we're still in a moment where Republicans and probably Democrats alike, where lawmakers are still watching where they step and how they walk around these issues, because they're still very uncertain about this moment that we are in. And tonight's hearing, and this morning's hearing, excuse me, largely focused on two of the three complaints that Dr. Bright brought in his opening statement, which he did not read in full. And the two, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about again, include his push against the drug hydroxychloroquine that hadn't been fully tested, something that the administration was pushing to be much more out in the market, including in the pharmacies, where all you needed was a doctor prescription rather than having to be under a hospital's observation by being inside the hospital. And then also his calls for additional emergency equipment, including PPEs, to be available back in January, which he said were largely ignored. A third issue that got very a little attention, and it's possible I might have missed it, but a third thing that he actually lays out in his complaint and even in his opening statement, which he did not read this morning, is that, again, as his role as the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, he oversees about $50 billion in contracts annually to pharmaceutical companies that are developing vaccines. And he claims that there was cronyism at play within this agency and who was getting these contracts. And he specifically says it was the friends of Jared Kushner, who and his friends in the pharmaceutical industry that were getting these contracts, and that it wasn't necessarily based just on, you know, the science and the research that each of the companies were doing.
Well, let's dig deeper into this with our first guest this morning. We are joined by Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, who also helped develop the framework for Dr. Bright's case. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Ian. I don't want to overstate my contribution. I gave some coaching to Dr. Bright's legal team on how whistleblower complaints operate at the Office of Special Counsel, but they did the work, not the Government Accountability Project.
Thank you, Tom, for that clarification. We are also joined on the line by Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher with Public Citizen. He's an expert on drug pricing, access to medicines, and global health. Good morning, Zane.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, Zane. I want to start with you. I want to hear what you think about it. The Republicans this morning seemed to really try to push forth this narrative that it made sense to do a mass distribution of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, without going through extensive testing, and then this drug, and dismiss the fact that, when that happened, it was ultimately demonstrated that people were more likely to die who took the drug than not.
Yeah, it's scandalous. You know, I think one of the remarkable things about this complaint, if you read it in full, is that each paragraph seems to become more scandalous than the paragraph preceding it. And the hydroxychloroquine example is just one of many of the sheer failure of the Trump administration to listen to experts and to follow what the science is saying. You know, Dr. Bright alleges, and you know, we have seen that the Trump administration recklessly promoted unproven drugs with known side effects, even though officials within the Trump administration fully recognized that there were safety concerns and there was a ton of internal pushback against widespread use of these malaria medicines.
Tom, I want to turn to you. You know, it's hard to paint a full picture in 5-minute question and answer segments of all that is at issue here. Can you walk us through the fullness of Dr. Bright's complaint? What did we not hear about or enough about in today's hearing?
Well, I don't think that they really covered the process of following through on his concerns. He basically has two fronts to his complaint. One, that he was illegally retaliated against by removing him from his responsibilities. And the second is blowing the whistle that the public has been sold out and is being endangered by the misconduct in the administration. There's different tracks for each of those. For defending his job, the Office of Special Counsel did a very timely investigation, found a reasonable belief that it violated the Whistleblower Protection Act, and asked, requested petition HHS to stay the reassignment, to freeze it while they complete the investigation. The problem with that is that all the special counsel can do is ask, because the president and Republicans in Congress have blocked appointments to the Merit Systems Protection Board, which enforces the Whistleblower Protection Act. Those requests don't have any teeth. So the special counsel made a significant finding, but it can't enforce it. The other trick is to get some corrective action to better protect the country against the public health threat that HHS has fallen down on. And from that perspective, the special counsel can order the Secretary of HHS to conduct an investigation of Dr. Bright's charges. They find a substantial likelihood that he was right. And according to media reports hot off the press before the hearing, they have just made that ruling. And that triggers a process where the agency head has to do a very thorough investigation whose requirements are specified by law. It can't be a quick and dirty whitewash. And then when it comes in, the whistleblower gets to comment on the adequacy of the investigation. The special counsel grades the agency's reaction, whether or not they responsibly address the problem. They can pass or fail it. And then the whole package, the agency report, the whistleblower's assessment of it and the special counsel's report card gets sent to the president in both branches in Congress and put in the public record. It's really an opportunity to lay the foundation for responsibly addressing breakdowns in government operations. And I'd just like to make a P.S. here. This is a real opportunity for lessons learned. With me, for the first whistleblower who inspired me to help whistleblowers about 40 years ago, FDA scientist named Dr. Tony Morris. The Ford administration wanted to declare victory against the swine flu by releasing a swine flu vaccine. Dr. Morris said that this would be dangerous. It would cause hundreds of deaths and thousands of cases of paralysis from Guillain-Barré syndrome because we hadn't checked all the side effects and done the adequate testing. Dr. Morris was fired, and that's exactly what happened. Hundreds of Americans died and thousands were paralyzed because we didn't follow the normal scientific method when we released those vaccines. They wanted a political victory. And I think the ultimate lessons here are that, for this pandemic or any, truth is the best medicine. And secondly, that political hidden agendas in political science, as opposed to the scientific method, is a clear and present danger to public health and safety.
Zane, today's hearing was supposed to be in part, or it's titled, you know, they're talking about protecting the integrity of public health. It didn't seem like that was actually what came up in the line of questioning, but it was more about denigrating the reputation of Dr. Bright. Your thoughts?
I think some parts of the hearing started exposing, you know, what is at the root of the complaint, which is that the Trump administration really ignored requests by career officials to prepare for COVID-19. I think the hydroxychloroquine thing gets a lot of attention, but the complaint talks about so much more. It's really remarkable if you follow the timeline as to what Dr. Bright is alleging. You know, as early as January, Dr. Bright claimed that he was urging HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, to dedicate appropriate resources for COVID-19. And at every instance, it seems, he was met with pushback. You know, there was a lack of urgency. There was insufficient funding. They were, you know, largely unconcerned about even things like shortages. Dr. Bright, for example, was in contact with a mask manufacturer way back in January. In January, the mask manufacturer was saying, things are getting bad, you know, we need action. And Dr. Bright was trying to facilitate action and kind of expedite the process. But unfortunately, he met with resistance and reluctance at every turn.
Tom, I think for a lot of us, when we think of whistleblowers, you know, we think of things that happen, you know, in secret, you know, that I would go to my superior or someone else, you know, and say privately that this is what's happening. And then, like we saw with the whistleblower around the impeachment hearings with Trump, you know, identity would be protected. Can you break down for us why Dr. Bright, who's been very public, falls into the whistleblower category?
Oh, sure. Whistleblowing is about exposing abuses of power that betray the public trust. Using free speech rights to expose those abuses of power. Sometimes they're deeply concealed, and sometimes they're just not in the public's radar screen. But that's exactly what Dr. Bright was doing, and the special counsel found a substantial likelihood that he was disclosing a substantial and specific danger to public health or safety. That's the legal standard for this type of whistleblowing. And, you know, in response to your earlier question, the attacks on Dr. Bright, you know, that's normal. It comes with the territory. What I've learned at the Government Accountability Project is that when institutions or people are abusing their power, and anyone threatens it, it's almost an instinct to destroy the threat to their abuse of power, and they've got the power to do it. So it makes it very difficult for whistleblowers. We nickname it like committing the truth because you're treated like you committed a crime. Dr. Bright needs to be braced for a steady drumbeat of attacks on him like this. President Trump was a big fan of whistleblowers when they were criticizing the Obama administration, but he tries to destroy everyone that challenges his abuses of power. So it's going to be a tough road, but he needs to do it. And I think it's important that your listeners know that what happened at CDC with Dr. Bright, it's just one example in the scientific field of something that's breaking down across the government. GAP is working right now with TSA. Federal Security Director Jay Brainard, and he's completely spooked because he's learned that TSA has become a major source, a major cause of spreading the pandemic germs, the coronavirus germs, and it's because at the airports, TSA staff and screeners didn't get any training on how to deal with the pandemic. TSA actually blocked shipment of PPEs to them, such as protective masks, and until 2 weeks ago wouldn't give federal security directors authority to require that they wore protective equipment. And then those same staff are touching passports or driver's licenses for everyone in line, and if there's somebody at the beginning of the line who infects the staff, they'll spread it to everybody else. Same thing with coming out of scanners when you're patted down, or your luggage being examined. There's no sterilization or sanitation between passengers, and TSA is spreading these. The whistleblower did some studying and found that at 5 different airports, geographically isolated from each other, where there hadn't been any surges of pandemics, there were simultaneously. It could only be coming from the airports. And the administration doesn't just have to get its vaccine act together. It has to get its act together across the board, or when we start flying again, we're going to spark another surge.
Yeah, when we start flying again. Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project, along with Zane Rizvi. Seems like that's the name of my primary care physician last name. He's a policy researcher with Public Citizen. I'm going to edit this and on the fly and listen to Catherine Ebon, investigative journalist. She has a couple of interesting articles up at Vanity Fair about this incident. She does mainly work on generic booms. Her latest book is Bottle of Lies, the Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom, which I've always thought of as a bit of a counterpoint to Big Pharma, but they're probably making money off of it as well. This is from a segment from Pacifica called U.S. House Hearing on Protecting Scientific Integrity in the COVID-19 Response. Quixotic, I guess. It's a show called Letters in Politics. You can find it at the archive of KPFA easily enough. And I'm going to go to this Catherine Eban. That's who I played at the beginning with this little segment that highlights the bit about cronyism. Jared Kushner's buddies getting some of the contracts for a variety of things. And 11 minutes left. We won't get to that repeated segment, but I put that on because I wanted to highlight it. Here's another segment, and this is with Catherine Eban. E-B-A-N is how her name is spelled. Her book just got an award as a top 10 scientific book, I guess, award. Yeah.
Claiming, as he testified this morning to the committee, that he was retaliated against and removed from that position overseeing vaccines, which is a very important position right now, as you can imagine, for his opposition to the Trump administration moving forward, making anti-malaria drugs available to combat the symptoms of the coronavirus. And since we have learned that it may not be effective and could be even hazardous to take this drug, even though the studies that have been done are small in size. For our friends listening to KPFK, you're just joining us now, and this is kind of our wrap-up and analysis of what has happened this morning. You, for your financial support, 5732. Phone number again for KPFK.
Chloroquine and hydrochloroquine. Her latest book, Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom, will be out in paperback in June this year. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So, you know, at today's hearing, this idea of whether hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine were or were not a good idea, and that that narrative shifted, whether it was Democrats or Republicans who were speaking. But I want to go back in time a little bit with you. And can you walk us through not only where did Trump get this idea, but then walk us through the Trump rollout plan of the drug throughout the country?
Yeah. So it looks like Trump began to seize on sort of anecdotal information which was being circulated on the internet and may have originated with a French scientist, that hydroxychloroquine was a sort of miracle drug when it came to treating COVID-19. The data that was circulating among the administration was really more anecdotal than definitive. But it looks like the Trump administration seized on that and also seized on some of the claims being made on the internet and by certain doctors that if you gave chloroquine early on, even before you had a definitive diagnosis of COVID-19, that patients would be cured. You know, this was a claim that came without definitive clinical evidence, and there were dangers to the drug as well because it can cause cardiac irregularities. But nonetheless, the administration forged a plan to disseminate this drug widely, even outside of the safeguards of clinical trials in hospitals, which is usually how you test whether a drug is effective to treat certain conditions. So that set off not only alarm bells within the administration, but also put the top sort of science and health people in the administration under extreme pressure to stockpile hydroxychloroquine widely. And that was the conflict that led ultimately to the dismissal of Rick Bright, who testified today.
Can you talk about the warning that being given to the Trump administration about the dangers of this drug, as well as the then subsequent pressure on the top health officials inside of the administration to move?
Yeah, well, the warnings were very clear because the top medical experts in the administration who formed a, you know, countermeasures task force basically said without real clinical data, which you collect in trials, in randomized, blinded trials in hospitals, unless you study the drug properly, there's really no way to know if it's effective in treating COVID-19. So they basically said, we shouldn't be stockpiling this drug and we shouldn't be promoting this drug until we know whether it's effective. But the Trump administration and Trump himself really ignored those warnings. And starting on March 19th, Trump, from the podium of the White House, hailed hydroxychloroquine as a game changer in the treatment of COVID-19. So that sparked a nationwide, worldwide shortages of the drug and forced officials at FDA and within HHS to begin this mad scramble to source the drug and get it into the stockpile. You know, and really this was more of a kind of promotional scheme than an appropriate medical plan. But Trump then got up and boasted that we have 29 million doses of this stuff in the stockpile. But what really concerned Dr. Bright, as he made clear in his testimony today, is that the plan was to distribute that stockpile of drugs to pharmacies where any patient could get it with a prescription from a doctor, as opposed to being monitored in rigorous hospital-based clinical trials. And that was the central conflict. And that basically led to, as he has said in his whistleblower complaint, led to his dismissal from his job as the head of BARDA.
Additionally, this type of rollout of the drug was a violation of the FDA's emergency rule, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So Bright, working with other career health officials, was able to sort of put guardrails on the Trump administration plan. So what they did is they got the FDA to pass what's called an emergency use authorization, which basically specified any chloroquine drugs from the stockpile are going to be used not at drugstores, but they're going to be used in hospital-based clinical trials. But then what happened was, ignoring their own emergency rule, the top Trump administration officials began pushing for wide distribution of those stockpiled drugs to pharmacies. And it was that conflict that ultimately led to his dismissal.
So knowing all of this, and knowing that also ultimately it was proven or demonstrated, the small test through veterans, that it's people that took the drug were two times more likely to die of chloroquine, and knowing what you know about the rollout and the rush of it and all the rules it violated, your response to Republican representatives this morning, not only denigrating Dr. Bright for sounding the alarm bell, but also uplifting that this was a smart, wise thing to do, and what else would you do in an epidemic when you have no other options?
Well, you know, this really goes to a central conflict, which is, it's a conflict among, you know, scientists and career politicians now that is playing out at the top of our government, which is, hey, we're in the middle of a pandemic. There's no known cures for this. So what's wrong with just trying anything, right? Just throwing everything at the wall and see what sticks. And basically what Bright was testifying today is there are safe ways to do this. And the safe ways to do this are long-established protocols. You know, you don't just have doctors writing prescriptions for dying patients. You test the drug in clinical trials. And these clinical trials can be stood up and done very, very quickly. So, for example, there's over 100 different clinical trials right now that are testing the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine against COVID-19. And so far, the data is not impressive. The data suggests that that this drug is not working effectively, you know, in treating this ailment. And it's sort of proving the scientists right, which is you can't really claim to know anything until you've done these, you know, rigorous clinical trials. And I thought it was interesting, you know, you had congressmen at the hearing today saying, hey, well, I know this guy who got better after he took these drugs. You know, and those are anecdotes, which I think, as one journalist wrote, it's like the equivalent of a Yelp review, you know, but it's not scientific proof. And so that is really the conflict that's playing out. What Bright testified is you have to empower scientists and enable them to tell the truth. And I would say the sort of through line of his testimony today is that Americans are not being told the truth about the dangers of this virus and the ways that they can work to help, you know, safeguard the country, basically.
Well, it's not, I mean, not only I think the assertion is that not only are Americans not being told the truth, but they're actively being lied to, which I think was at the heart of a lot of the conversation that we heard this morning.
Yes, I think that's fair. Yes, he is claiming that they are being lied to, that they're being, basically they're being told that this is not a big deal, that the virus will go away, that, you know, hey, these drugs might just work perfectly, that we're going to be able to get a vaccine by the fall. And he's basically, like Dr. Fauci, who testified 2 days ago, you know, throwing cold water on those claims.
That's Catherine Eban. There's only 3 minutes left, and that's the part that I played about cronyism at the top of the hour, or the top of this segment, with Features Pacifica's special coverage of the Richard Bright, Dr. Bright's hearing. Catherine Eban, pretty prolific on this subject with Vanity Fair. The topics, the last three articles. He was fired for being right. Richard Bright warns Congress time is running out. Second one, political connections and cronyism in a blistering whistleblower complaint, dot, dot, dot. And then really want to flood New York and New Jersey. Internal documents reveal Team Trump's chloroquine project. I have an anecdotal reference to its success and apparent success.